Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Name Three Songs. I'm Sarah Fagan.
I'm Jenna Million, and this is a podcast where we challenge sexism in the music industry and empower fangirls. Because let's be honest, fangirls knew about that band way before you did.
And if you stick around long enough, we'll also let you in on some new music the girls are already crazy about. Before we get into today's episode, we do have a new Patreon member, which is so exciting. Mira, we are so happy to have you. And honestly, this is another exciting Patreon member because she just happened across our Pete Wentz to Harry Styles timeline episode, which, as you all know, is my baby, my pride and joy, my unhinged thought of the decade, my life. And she really resonated with it, which honestly boosted my ego. I'm going to live off that high that I got from her intro on our Discord server for the rest of my days. So yeah, I mean, if you are enjoying our podcast, you can come hang out with us on Patreon. I promise it's a really good time. We do have a Discord server, as I already mentioned, but we also have mini episodes where we talk about news and things happening in pop culture that have to do with music. So obviously we have an episode discussing the Grammys, as well as all the other crazy things that have been happening in the news lately, because I feel like so much has been going on just because it's been Grammy season. So the celebs have been out and about making a mess of the world. And as well as that, we do also have a tier where you have Music Meltdowns, which is a monthly bonus episode, which we're putting a lot more research into. We recently did our March episode where we talked about how music can lead to cults. And it honestly sounds unhinged, sounds ridiculous, but we talk about everybody from Jared Leto to Charles Manson, and it is a wild ride, but a good ride. I do have one more announcement before we jump into talking about what today's episode is about. We're expanding the offerings of what Name Three Songs can give to you. You know, for a long time, if you followed us on social media, that we've asked time and time again what artists you think we should talk to, have on the podcast, interview, etc. And we've been trying to figure out the best way to get artists involved, because we know that artist interviews aren't everybody's cup of tea, and that our normal Sunday episodes aren't usually what you would expect out of an artist interview. And so in order to come up with something, we finally landed on the best way to do this, which is to give you guys a bonus episode whenever we get the opportunity to interview somebody who really is in line with the Name Three Songs mission and ethos. And so in 2 Wednesdays from now, so Wednesday, April 27th, we do have our first ever interview dropping with an artist that we think you guys are going to be really excited about. It was a really great conversation that we had. It's really on point with the ethos of Name Three Songs. And since this is a bonus episode, you'll still be getting your 2 monthly Sunday episodes. You'll get to meet a new artist and find out about them and how feminism has affected their life and their music. And it's a really, really, really great chat. And I'm so excited for you guys to hear it. And so with all that out of the way, Jenna, what are we getting into today?
Yes, this episode is kind of a long time in the making because I've been thinking about these ideas for a very long time and not knowing how to put them together in an actual episode. But essentially today, we are having on a very special guest who is going to take us through the journey of culture from Western culture to Eastern culture. And of course, we're talking about this in the context of K-pop. So what that means for Western fans, being a fan of something that is Korean, that is very different from us, and the ways in which we interact as fans, the ways in which K-pop idols interact with their fans, the ways in which culture is meant to be consumed by different people all over the world, aka globalization, and the ways in which particularly American culture has evolved into this call-out culture, especially on the internet, things that people maybe don't agree with, automatically applying super negative terms to them when the action itself maybe isn't negative. There is a lot to unpack. but we have a wonderful guest to explain all of this and help us through this journey. So, Sarah, would you like to introduce us to our guest?
Yes. So today's guest is Dr. Thomas Bodinette. He holds a PhD and a BA honors first class in Japanese studies from Monash University and is a cultural anthropologist whose work has explored consumption of popular culture among queer communities in Japan, mainland China, Thailand, and the Philippines. He has a particular interest in the transnational spread of Japanese queer pop culture and its impact on conceptualizations of gender and sexuality, and he also investigates K-pop fandom in Japan and Australia. Tom joins us from Sydney, Australia, so we recorded this in multiple time zones, multiple days of the week, and he honestly was just like the coolest dude, had so many good thoughts. My brain was going up in fireworks throughout this conversation, and I'm so glad that Jenna brought him to the land of Name Three Songs. So Jenna, how did you find Tom?
So you guys may remember that previously we did an episode called K-pop Capitalism and the Illusion of the American Dream, and that featured Stephanie from the K-pop Cast podcast. And Thomas has been a frequent guest on the K-pop Cast as well as in their Twitter spaces. So when I was getting into K-pop last summer, I was super active on Twitter trying to learn as much as I could about K-pop. I found this podcast and I joined a lot of the Twitter spaces that they did, and I learned a lot from Thomas, and that's why I wanted to have him on the podcast. So if you guys need a refresher and want to go check out that episode, we'll have it linked in the description below. But also, if you guys are K-pop fans or you just want to learn more about K-pop, we definitely recommend going and checking out our friends over at the K-pop Cast, because they have very similar missions to us, you know, subverting sexism and thinking critically about our favorite pop music. You know, we're not afraid to criticize our faves. We're not afraid to call things out. They do weekly K-pop dose of song recommendations, industry interviews, and they do deep dive analyses on K-pop songs, all from the vantage point of social justice and critical thinking. So you can see, we have a lot in common. And they did have a recent episode talking specifically about a girl group called Idol and their recent song Tomboy in the context of the anti-feminist presidency within South Korea. So if those songs sound interesting to you, we will also have that linked in the description below. But without further ado, let's get into our episode today. Hi, Tom. Welcome to Name Three Songs, and thank you so much for joining us today all the way from Sydney, Australia.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
We are very, very, very excited for this conversation. I'm very personally invested in this. I think our listeners are going to learn a lot today, and we're also going to learn a lot, so I'm very excited. And so just to get into a gist of what we're talking about today, we are looking at the relationship between Western audiences and Eastern media. And particularly, we're probably going to talk a lot about K-pop, considering that we're a music podcast and K-pop is super popular right now. So looking at kind of like how we consume media, how cultures expand and globalize, and kind of the different conversations that come up within fandom and within maybe the critics of these fandoms or the critics of this globalization, and looking at the many different layers that fall under this umbrella. And so to kick things off, could you just explain what is the purpose of culture and like how do we interact with different cultures?
So I am a cultural anthropologist at heart, so I have particular understandings of this big term culture. And this is a word that means a lot of things to a lot of people, and it's very difficult to pin down. But within my thinking and the thinking of the discipline within which I operate, this idea of anthropology, culture is basically anything that emerges out of human interaction that is not natural. So it's something that is created specifically through human interaction that contours or influences beliefs, behaviors, rituals, forms of practice, art, literature, and of course music. All of this is what we call cultural. And what's really important within the way that I think about culture and that many of my colleagues think about culture is that it's not static and it's not homogenous. So this is very fancy, but what we mean by that is by saying that culture is something that is different for different people, even if there are lots of kind of shared experiences or shared beliefs, The culture still emerges through a personal relationship with, for example, media. But when we say it's not static, I think this is the most important point because it doesn't stay the same. Culture, through human history, through human interaction, day to day, is always evolving. And it's something that is designed to change. So humans do not live our lives in stasis. We live our lives dynamically and we shape the world around us. And that active process of shaping the world is what we call culture. So it's moving, it's fluid. And I think that that's really very key to recognize when we're talking about the reception of, for example, K-pop in the West, because we need to recognize already at the very the beginning of that conversation that K-pop as a culture shifts and changes depending on where it's being consumed and by whom and for what purposes.
I feel like that's like a really helpful definition of something that I think a lot of people just would assume would have like a really easy answer, but like there's so much more depth to all of this. And something that I feel like Jenna and I have brought up in past episodes about K-pop as well as like boy bands and all that stuff is like the conversation about K-pop boy bands and English or American boy bands is so different, even though the music is very similar sounding, like the vibes are very similar. But obviously K-pop is like a much different industry than like the more Western pop music industry is. But the conversation around K-pop by fans and by media is so vastly different because there's just a bunch of people from other cultures who don't fully understand like the culture behind that. And it really leads to so many questions and so much misunderstanding, which is why we keep doing these episodes and having people come on to like help us help our listeners and ourselves like understand the whole like differentiation between these like a lot more.
When it comes to culture, one of the things that I think it's always important to remember is that it's always going to be messy. The natural state of life, the universe and everything, if you will, is chaos, right? But we have this strong urge to try and organize it, humans, right? And this attempt to organize is one of those ideas that we call culture. This attempt to compartmentalize, define, kind of hierarchize and so forth. But the thing is that people from different backgrounds, from different contexts, will do that differently based on their different situations. So this is one of the reasons why we see so much difference between two kind of pop culture industries that on the surface look very similar, but at the same time are vastly different. And that difference in similarity, I think, is the fundamental truth of human life, whether we're talking about like the big picture or whether we're talking about, you know, fandom for kind of Korean boy band like BTS. And this is just a truism, right? And I think that any conversation around the reception of East Asian media in any context, whether that be a Western context like North America or Australia, the two societies we find ourselves in, or for instance, the Philippines, a site where I do a lot of research, or Japan, like we need to be aware of the various cultural milieus that that reception is taking place in, because there is no one correct dominant form of reception. Though we can certainly historicize and say when it comes to K-pop, for instance, that the norms of the South Korean music industry produced certain things, certain ideas, but then it's the reception within different contexts and the negotiation with the norms that were produced in South Korea is where new cultural forms are emerging. And I was recently thinking about this a lot because I've been writing about kind of K-pop fans in Australia and the Philippines recently, and just kind of getting my head around the idea of how culture really responds to the local context and how K-pop has become this globalized transnational thing, which means that there's no true center anymore. Like, it really depends on where you are, how you make sense of things. And I think that that's really important when thinking about culture, is that we tend to, in kind of simplistic debates such as the ones that you see on social media, for instance, we tend to privilege the origin of a kind of media form as the default lens to make sense of it. And then we forget that people are consuming within a context where they are, to use a fancy word, enculturated, so that where they're viewing a particular culture as normative, and that that person is creating new cultural knowledge within their context through engaging with something that's transnationalized.
This is super fascinating as we talk in relationship to fandom, because it feels like, and this might be something very like American specific, because there's so many different cultures that have come together into America to kind of produce an entirely different culture. Like, we talk a lot about like white people in America not really having a lot of roots to like wherever their ancestors immigrated from. And I feel like because of that, as you said earlier, like people, human nature, to want to like organize things or set rules on things. And I feel like we're seeing a lot of policing yeah. of culture online. And I feel like that right now is what is being applied to K-pop. I mean, kind of one of the reasons that I wanted to have this conversation was that the conversations that I was seeing online among fans and among like non-fans who were like projecting onto K-pop fandom is that there seems to be a lot of call-out culture right now, of course, but the way that I've seen this transpire within K-pop is the idea that fans are fetishizing K-pop idols. And while cultural fetishization does happen, and I'm sure there's fans in extreme cases in which this is happening, number one, this tends to feel like a very negative term in a way to like shut down people and their fandom, and also just in general, like a very big exaggeration with how most fandom works. And so I'm curious, what are your thoughts on this kind of conversation that we're seeing transpire recently?
So I think the first thing that I would flag is that all of this is very natural because of what I was saying about culture, is that it's something that we create actively. So it's mm-hmm. only natural that people will engage very consciously and strategically and deliberately in attempts to define or make sense of things through their own personal experiences. And if your personal experiences is one in which you have been minoritized, marginalized, discriminated against, or what have you, then it's only natural that you're going to have a suspicion, a deep suspicion towards these structures, like the dominant structures that have excluded you. And one of the beautiful things about K-pop that my research into the fandom in the Asia Pacific has revealed, particularly I do a lot of work with LGBTQ+ fans of K-pop, is just how people can draw upon K-pop as a resource to advocate for their own position within a society that kind of structures them as somehow abnormal or problematic. But on the flip side of this, we also see people who perhaps without really intending to be very kind of problematic and whose hearts are very much in the right place. And I think that I want to flag this at the outset, is that a lot of these criticisms that we're going to be talking about today are coming from people whose positionalities and whose actual ideas and politics are good, right? Like they're mm-hmm. engaged in good political activism. But the thing is that through taking culture as a monolith and through pushing forward stereotypes or focusing too much on one structural concern without considering other kind of personal concerns or contextual concerns, what these people end up doing is that they actually fall into the trap of treating culture as monolithic and static. And in trying to police and define what is good ethical behavior and good fandom, they're actually, unfortunately, falling into the trap of moving away from the very goal that they're seeking to look at. So for people who put forward the idea that those from a Western culture who engage with K-pop fandom in a particular way are always already involved in something such as fetishization, whatever that may mean, and I know we'll talk about that in a second, or sexualization, once again, whatever that may mean, we'll define it later. What they're doing is they're closing doors, and they're not necessarily celebrating the potential that culture has to kind of challenge certain beliefs that we view as, to quote the kind of constitution or the declaration of you know, independence, truths that we hold to be self-evident, right? But no truth is self-evident. No truth can emerge without having been debated or brought into being or discussed in depth. And so what happens when people close the door to debate is that they're closing the door to people's realization of the problem. So this is my concern around the so-called quote-unquote call-out culture, in the sense that it comes from a good place. It's often being deployed in really important political ways, particularly when it comes to the racial politics of the United States. I want to flag that. Though to your American listeners, I would remind you that the racial politics of the United States are particular to the United States, and that it's always important to remember that, and that it is fundamentally misunderstanding culture, and that's the problem. And so whilst these debates have political merit, and there's certainly people with whom I agree from their political perspective, I find their strategies or their, what we call their discourse, the way they speak about things, concerning.
Yeah. Something that we had touched on when we, the three of us, had initially talked, and a topic that I bring up time and time again, is like the accidental 180 liberals or leftists find themselves in when they try and stick up for others outside of their race or outside of their gender or sexual orientation. And they kind of wind up taking this sharp right turn into conservatism by accident, because in trying to protect people that they might not 100% understand and like police people who might be like appreciating a culture, instead they're like, oh, you're appropriating, oh, you're fetishizing. And I think that this is like why Jenna and I really wanted to talk about this topic in particular, is because a lot of times these people are stamping and yelling at people for quote unquote fetishizing these K-pop stars because they're just objectifying them in the same way that we would have objectified One Direction or the Backstreet Boys or whatever boy band it was that we were obsessed with. And so I guess with that being said, because I know like fetishization has like is real, has like a place in like kink culture and also in negative connotations as well. So can you, for everybody, like give some background on what exactly fetishization is and like where it would make sense when people are calling people out in the K-pop realm, and like where it literally is just people being accidentally racist and being and like just calling out objectification with the wrong word?
The conversation around appropriation versus appreciation is incredibly complicated and incredibly difficult due to a lot of the structural concerns that exist within our culture, particularly transnational white supremacy and the kind of domination of the music market by the North American music market and its appropriation of black music in particular. And it's important to remember that K-pop plays an important role within that, and that black fans of K-pop have been quite rightfully angry about issues of appropriation. But I think that there's legitimate conversations around appropriation, and then there's conversations around appropriation that devolve into stereotypes or devolve into a lack of concern for individual agency and the ability for people to reflectively engage with things. And I think that I want to focus on that idea of reflection, because a lot of these debates over fetishization, which I will define in a minute, Sarah, sorry, is this idea that fans who are quote-unquote fetishizing idols or engaging in these kinds of quote-unquote problematic practices do so in a non-reflexive, acritical way. But most fans are highly engaged consumers. The idea of the quote-unquote delulu fan, the delusional fan, is actually, you know, my research with fans, my interviews with many fans in many different contexts have revealed that fans know what they're doing. They understand what they're doing, and they think carefully about what they're doing. And in fact, these debates, whilst they can be concerning for sure, also indicate reflexivity and engagement with ethics on behalf of fandoms. And this idea of debating the problems is an indication that people are trying to make sense of the structural issues and the structural problems that exist. Where fetishization comes in is fetishization is the opposite of what I'm talking about. It's when things are acritical. It's when the fantasy overtakes the critical ethical consumption and the person does fall into practices that are areflexive, appropriative, and most importantly, acritical. So this idea of critical, and when I say critical, I don't mean negative. What I mean is questioning what you're doing very consciously. So to kind of talk about the history of this term fetish, within anthropological literature and sociological literature, when this term initially emerged, it emerged within the context of making sense of religious ritual. So a fetish object within the context of religious ritual is an object within which kind of ritualized power and mystical energy has been invested. So basically you have a fetish object which within the context of a religious ritual has become imbued with some kind of extra fantastic energy. And so it's a fantasy object. And it's an object through which fantasy is enacted, desires are realized, but it's also an object in which people invest their fantasies, invest energy, and in so doing, they remove the need for them to be active agents within the production of desire and fantasy. So within a lot of the contemporary cultural discussion of fetishization that we now kind of take for granted and that everyone's throwing around willy-nilly on Twitter and Instagram, we're actually seeing this concept as it was further refined by someone that many of the people who use the term casually are probably completely unaware of the fact that they did it, and this was Karl Marx. So we've got all of these people kind of acritically throwing around Marxist terminology without realizing that they're doing so. Not that there's anything problematic with using Marx, but there's problems when you use Marx without understanding what Marx is all about. So Marx is when he was writing about fetish, what he was writing about was the transformation of labor into capital, right? And the production of capital through the exploitation of the surplus production of a disadvantaged working class, right? The thing is that when he's writing about fetish, he's talking about how certain objects within the capitalist system have come to be imbued with all sorts of extra values that they don't actually have, and in so doing, it has alienated us from the human critical emotion, like our ability to think and to think about our positioning within the world and to recognize how we are kind of suppressed by various structures. Mm-hmm. So fetishization within the Marxist context is basically money is a fetish. So currency is a fetish because it brings into existence a relationship between capital and labor that doesn't actually exist. So to take this all the way to cultural fetishization, it is basically the process through which someone invests all sorts of fantasy into an object in order to kind of escape from and produce these kind of emancipatory ideas. But the problem is that in so doing, they're actually neglecting the true structures of disadvantage that exist in the world. So to take this finally to the idea of fetishizing a K-pop idol, what you're doing is that you're investing all of your emancipatory hopes and dreams and your perhaps sexual desires into a K-pop idol without taking into consideration that this K-pop idol is a flesh and blood human being, or considering the broader cultural context and structural industrial context that has created the idol. So you're basically using them as an empty tool to just dump all of your frustrations in and kind of seek emancipatory help. And that is a process that is acritical. You don't think about it. So yes, this is a very long answer, but what I'm suggesting is that we use the term fetishization to talk about people who have kind of like weird kinks or maybe kind of prefer Asian boys in unsavory ways. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But what we should be focusing on is the acritical consumption. And there are people who invest into K-pop as an emancipatory release for all of their tensions who do so critically and are aware of the history and the cultural production. They're not fetishizing. They're engaging in a sophisticated transnational negotiation of what a popular culture form can do when it circulates globally. That's something to be celebrated. But the problem is that for some people, they're unable to recognize the distinction between those two things. So to boil it down into the simplest terms, fetishization is bad faith fandom. It's fandom engaging in a kind of selfish and self-centered and problematic form of engagement that is unethical, that does not take into account the broader structural constraints within which fandom occurs.
That was great. I loved every second of it.
We mentioned this a little bit in our initial chat with you of, I think using like money as a prime example of like what a fetish is really honestly blew my mind. And as you were describing it again this time, I thought of NFTs, which is kind of the same thing. I have been
railing against NFTs in K-pop over the last few months. And partly because I just constantly get these requests from NFT and like crypto journos to kind of talk about it. I'm kind of like, fans don't want it because it's exploitative. No one wants it because it's killing the environment. It adds no value. There's no purpose to it. But this is exactly it. Like it's creating value where value doesn't exist.
Mm.
And in this instance, what we're talking about when it comes to problematic fetishization within a cultural fandom context, it's creating all of these personal emancipatory values that are kind of a little bit, it's really hard to kind of explain it. But there's something off, like there's a certain weirdness to it. And that's why I say bad faith, because you're not celebrating these people as individuals or their achievements, or you're not celebrating the kind of wonderful kind of beauty that is the K-pop industry and what it can bring. What you're doing is you're investing like all of your kind of hopes and dreams into OPA, and like hoping that, you know, like, oh yeah, my identity is now just being an angry army on Twitter and like advocating about my favorite member constantly and getting involved in these useless fan wars that don't serve anyone. That's a critical consumption because you're not thinking about things. Likewise, when someone is critiquing, say, a white North American fan of K-pop from the perspective of Asian American politics, you have two things that are going on here. A legitimate critique of a fan who is not aware of and considering what is important about what it means to consume, you know, Asian media within a marketplace within which Asian representation and hate crimes against Asian people have been increasingly concerning. But most fans are well aware of the fact that K-pop and BTS in particular are breaking those stereotypes, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're going to blanket approach and critique and say that only Asian Americans or only Asian people have a right to celebrate K-pop, then you're actually arguing against your broader point of deconstructing racial boundaries. So this is where the debate becomes complicated, and where appropriation and this idea of intentionality and reflexivity becomes important, and where we really need to remember that fetishization is empty fantasizing as opposed to fantasizing that is embedded within a cultural context and a reflexive process of making sense of oneself. To go really hardcore about this, we make sense of the world through our fantasies and our fantasies of the other. Like, we make sense of ourselves through engaging with our fantasies of other people, right? And if that other is very different from ourselves, it actually opens us up to all sorts of new ways of thinking. So that's something to celebrate. That's actually radical politics. That's progressive. Yeah. We shouldn't be policing that. That's good. Yeah. We want to encourage more of that.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I think like one of the reasons why Sarah knows this, but we were having this conversation like a few months ago, which is like, I don't understand why everyone's using this word, because to me, I'm like, they're all using the word wrong. And in doing so, the word doesn't have meaning anymore. And they're like using it to call out things that it's not. And so I was like having a really hard time understanding like what it actually was in like a real example. But the other thing is like thinking back on like being a fan of One Direction, nobody ever said we were fetishizing One Direction. And I'm like, when did this word become popular? And I feel like a lot of times it's applied particularly when we're talking about things that are a different culture or a different race than your own.
So I think that also, Jenna, what you're saying is interesting, because when I was just doing some research to like see what fans were talking about on this topic and stuff, I came across a YouTube video of like a college-aged Korean-American boy who was saying how most of his life growing up, like nobody had a crush on him, people would make fun of him, all this stuff. And then once BTS got popular, like these girls started paying attention to him and all this stuff. And then when they would follow him on Instagram, when he would see who they were following, they would follow like BTS and NCT and like all these sorts of groups and that sort of stuff. And he was saying how he had a really hard time dealing with it because most of them didn't know him. They were just like, saw him, followed him on Instagram, and then would like slide in his DMs or whatever. And he was like, I was having a hard time understanding if they were like fetishizing me or if BTS becoming popular was making people more aware of Korean people and their culture and all this stuff. And so therefore, I no longer was an other and I was something that they understood. And I thought that that was just a really interesting statement and something that, Tom, it feels like you're kind of hitting at in what you've been saying, in that like K-pop being big and like this idea of like people fetishizing and all this stuff in some senses is also just like culture expanding and people not 100% understanding how to interact and communicate with cultures that they don't 100% understand. And I think, Jenna, again, that's probably why the fetish term hasn't ever been used with like these white boy bands and why it's a term that feels so confusing, because there's so many wrong ways to utilize it. And also to some BTS fans, the fact that they're Korean has just like opened their eyes to the fact that like, oh, Korean people exist. And like, I didn't really know about that before. But to other people, it's kind of like made the fact that they only like Korean people okay. And so there's all these blurry lines and it's so intricate and so interesting.
I think that that's a really perfect example of what I said earlier around culture being messy. And I think to kind of like speak to what you were saying, Jenna, as well, is that we are in one of those moments of great cultural change, right? Like the rise of BTS, the increasing kind of visibility of K-pop within, in particular, the North American music market, which for better or worse plays an important role in contouring and influencing global music trends, is significant because it is changing the discourse. The thing is that this rate of change for different people is going to be slower or faster depending upon one's familiarity, but also depending on one's context. And for some people who have been engaging with things in one way and who have been doing so from particular political perspectives that have yet to expand, or who are focusing on particular issues over others, then there is going to be disconnect. And I think that what we're seeing here, particularly with this term fetishization and also discussions around sexualization, which is, I think, another kind of empty signifier. We actually, Jenna, have a term for this in social science. We call these terms empty signifiers. So people use them without understanding what they actually mean, just to inject any kind of meaning. So basically, fetishization has
describing the internet right now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, period. Fetishization is being used because, like, anything that's bad is fetishization, right? Yeah. Like, so we'll use this word because it sounds bad and people know that it's a bad word. So if I can say, oh, you're just treating it as a fetish, it's a signifier basically saying in the context of a discussion, you're not doing this politically correctly, you're not doing this right, let me tell you what I think is the right way to do this. And that's why I think it's really important to be familiar with what fetishization actually means, because a lot of what, as you say, Jenna, a lot of what people say is fetishization is not fetishization. And to talk about what Sarah was, is kind of that example of cultural, like, taste is shifting. Suddenly the kind of positioning of Asian male subjects as always already undesirable and invisible within global culture is changing. And for someone who has grown up in an environment where you have been invisible for such a long time, this huge shift, like this huge shift within the ways people think about the desirability of Asian subjects, and also the long legacy of Asian women actually being fetishized within white culture. Like, it makes sense that you're going to lump and return to what was a way of making sense of this in the past. But the fact of the matter is that cultures change. And it sounds like this particular, you know, YouTuber that you mentioned is coming to terms with what is a very positive thing. That for some people, suddenly Korea is on the map and Korean boys are on the map. And hey, presto, wow, Asians can be attractive, which is ridiculous. Because of course they can be, because everyone can be attractive. But, you know, throwing off the shackles of particular cultures and embracing a more expansive cosmopolitan culture, it takes time.
It's really interesting, like, as we're talking about, like, fetish has been, like, a term that's really popular right now, and it's really popular within the context of K-pop, but it's, like, part of the conversation is breaking it down to sexualization or objectification. And I think when we talk about that in, like, American pop star conversation, it looks very different. Like, it's always, like, oh, the media is sexualizing Taylor Swift, or, like, Taylor Swift, Megan Thee Stallion is sexualizing herself on stage when she wears those tiny outfits. It's stuff like this, but when we look at it in the context of K-pop, it's like the fans are sexualizing them. Like, it's always the fans' fault, but in American context, it's always, like, the system's fault. I think that's very interesting.
It's also such a bizarre statement within the context of K-pop, because one of these discourses about sexualization, and basically sexualization within fan discourse in Anglophone context in particular, is one of these empty signifiers. So, like, fetishization, I like to think of it this way. Fetishization is anything bad that touches on race. Sexualization is anything bad that touches on sex. And they're just empty signifiers for people who, like, we shouldn't be using sex or sexual desire as the lens through which to make sense of K-pop, which is quite frankly bullshit, because whilst yes, there's minors involved in K-pop production and the sexualization of minors is always problematic, that's a very different issue, right? That's just anything involving minors is always already going to be, you know, sex is not the default way we engage with minors. But K-pop idols are sexual beings because they're human, and unless they are asexual, and none of them have, I think, really come out asexually as of yet. There is an aromantic idol, I know that, but I don't think anyone's come out as asexual yet. But the fact of the matter is that they're sexual beings and they have sexual agency, and they're not like these puppets completely controlled by their agencies. When they get up on stage and perform skinship or fan service to trigger like homoerotic kind of fantasies, or when an idol dances around and rips off their shirt to show off their chiseled bodies, or when some when a female girl group involves themselves in this kind of really cool sexy girl crush concept, like, they're not doing so as if they are completely agentless kind of puppets within this evil industry. They are willing participants within the K-pop industry. They know exactly what's involved. I'm sure that some of them enjoy. I mean, we have instances where we have, like, for example, Choi Min Ho of SHINee going on like a variety show and saying, oh yeah, I enjoy it when the fans look at my body. That's why I work out. Like, they're sexual beings. So this idea that we cannot engage with idols through the lens of human sexuality is ludicrous, because sexuality is one of the lenses through which we understand the world. And whilst it is certainly the case that we can be criticizing structural issues around sexuality and sexualization, for example, the sexualization of women in the K-pop industry, or the incredibly heteropatriarchal issues around K-pop's production and consumption, or the thorny debate over queer baiting and its role in shipping culture. Like, these are structural, legitimate debates that we can have. But to say that fans should not be engaging with things sexually is such a puritanical statement. And it also neglects the fact that companies, for better or worse, assume that sexual desire is going to be one of the reasons why people engage in K-pop. And they cater to it, just as they cater to all the other desires that exist. And, you know, we're human. Sex is not bad, people. We're human. So I don't understand it. Like, I honest to God don't understand it. And when it comes to people whose sexual desires are marginalized or criticized by society, such as LGBTQI plus subjects, you know, who engage with K-pop in particular ways. Maybe they ship idols not to quote-unquote fetishize them, but as a way to explore their own queer desires for, you know, other men or women or whatever. Hey, presto, good thing. This is emancipatory. This is important. We should be celebrating that, not shutting it down. So I think that for me, one of the big things is that so many of these debates over fetishization, sexualization, what have you, what is good, correct fandom, what is bad fandom, are so black and white. The world isn't black and white. It's grey. It's messy. For God's sake. I said this a few times already, but we need to celebrate that messiness. Messy is normal. Mm-hmm. Messy is good. Messy gives us everything that we like about the world. Like, attempts to make things unmessy, well, that's, guys, you know what that's called? That's called fascism, and we don't like fascism. Oh my God. So, you know what I mean?
You're literally, like, setting fireworks off in my brain because you're making all the points that I'm always yelling about, which is just, like, the world is all a gray area. We're allowed to have homoeroticism. People are allowed to have sexual agency. Calm the fuck down. Because, like, as anybody who listens to our podcast and anybody new is going to learn, like, I am very much, like, an outsider to the K-pop world. I'm more aware than I once was just because Jenna's very much into it now, and, like, I'm definitely trying to understand everything. But from what I've picked up and, like, from the outside perspective, again, it's like K-pop is, and, like, calculated always feels like a bad word, but it's very much like an industry where there's, like, lots of, like, boxes that they're supposed to tick or whatever. And I feel like because people are aware of how quote-unquote calculated it is as an industry, like, there's the assumption that, like, oh, they're not supposed to date in public, they're not sexual beings. And again, there's going to be some fans being like, you can't sexualize them because they don't want to be sexualized. Meanwhile, they're saying that they don't mind it, or they're doing these things like, you use the buzzword of the day, fan service, where they're doing things because they're so aware of, like, what fans are wanting them to do, or, like, what fans kind of, like, what, not, like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, get turned on by or excited by them doing or whatever. And there's a very symbiotic relationship between K-pop idols and their fans, which is very different to, like, Western musicians, because a lot of the times, even though fans are like, you wouldn't be here without us, the musicians are like, yeah, we would be. Whereas, like, K-pop idols are like, no, we wouldn't be.
Yeah.
And so they do a lot more and they give a lot more to their fans. And so if their fans kind of want them, like, it seems at least, want them to be sexual objects, they kind of lean into it a little bit, which I think is good in a lot of senses, because, again, it's that same thing of, it's like making things that feel taboo or feel different seem more accessible. So while it's very different than, like, culture, it is something that, like, a lot of people may feel uncomfortable with, like, with people being sexual, with people having homoerotic subtext, but in real life, or whatever the case may be. And so I just think it's really interesting that you brought all those points up, and how it's like, we are human, we are sexual beings. It's inevitable that they're going to be sexy on stage dancing, they're going to be acting in these ways. But unfortunately, I am going to ask you to give another definition to people and explain a little bit, because I know, like, fan service exists in, like, the comic book video game realm, which is, like, why I'm mostly aware of it, of, like, fun little Easter eggs, fun little, like, moments they put in into series to give fans that, like, fan service of witnessing that thing happen. But when fan service exists within real life people, it's, like, a much different experience, I would think. So can you give a little bit of context and information as to, like, what exactly fan service is and what a sexual example, so to speak, of, like, how they would give that to fans in that way?
So fan service is something that is very prevalent within the idol music industries of East and Southeast Asia. And it's actually one of the kind of defining differences between celebrity culture in North America and Western Europe versus East and Southeast Asia. That fan service is performative but strategic, and done deliberately and openly. Behaviors and kind of engagements between idols or by an idol in order to satisfy a fan desire. Or if I wanted to be more actually correct, I would say that fan service is the creation of and then satisfaction of those desires. So mm-hmm. what companies are doing is that they're producing moments that are designed to spike a really visceral, effective, or emotional response on behalf of fans, and in so doing, kind of educate the fans into consuming in particular ways. And then once that desire has been seeded within the fandom, then the idols will consistently return to it and stoke it and bring it back through various performances. So I would say that fan service is true of all celebrity kind of cultures, and it's also something that is built into celebrity cultures. It's just that the ways in which it operates and its visibilization, and more importantly, its acknowledgement, is very different. So the thing that is different is that in the West, fan service is kind of hush-hush. But at the same time, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, I wrote this song for my fans, or I'm going to give a special performance just for my fans, you know. You know, that's okay. Like, that's normal, right? Like, a concert is something that is sold because, like, you're performing for your fans, right? But in Asia, they're just so much more open about what they're doing. They're kind of like, oh, you like it when these two boys touch each other? Okay, we'll get them to touch each other. What? You want them to kiss? Okay, now kiss. Like, that's the thing. Like, and it's just responding to things that the fans want. And more importantly, the idols who have gone through a rigorous trainee program, which, you know, for better or worse, is rigorous and has some problems, let's be honest. But they're well aware, like, no one becomes a K-pop idol without knowing the fact that K-pop shipping happens. No man will ever join a boy band in Korea without knowing that there is going to be the potential for them to be shipped. I have a colleague who's currently working at New York University who has done interviews with very, very many K-pop idols, both trainees and professional idols, including some names that I won't mention, but like big names. And they are 100% like, oh yeah, we do fan service. We know that they write these fics about us, and it doesn't really bother us because we know it's just the fans having fun, and that they understand that, like, you know, that it's just something that we have to do. It's part of the job. No, it doesn't freak me out because I always knew that I had to do it, right?
Yeah.
And this is the thing that these discourses on social media or the anti-shippers don't quite get. There is this phenomenon that we call folk etymology within anthropology, which is this idea that people create their own kind of narratives to make sense of things in society, but they don't actually know how things work. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of, like, people who think they know how the K-pop industry works, but they don't actually know how the K-pop industry works. Now, yeah. I've never done any work together with K-pop companies, but I'm a consultant for a large Japanese idol company called Johnny's and Associates. And mm-hmm. like, conversations I've had with them, I can't talk about them due to privilege, but like, the people at the company know 100% what fans are doing, and they want to know how best to cater to what the fans are doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, the conversation I had with this particular company was like, how do we get fan group A to be more, like, you know, involved in our idols fandom? This is what we're doing. Why is it not working? And this is the thing, fans, like, idols know what they're doing. Like, everyone, K-pop fans make these jokes about idols having burner accounts on Twitter and monitoring. Yeah, because they do. They do. It's real.
Oh my god. And this is like, that's like such a huge conversation on TikTok too. Like, oh my god, like, they see everything. Like, they might see this. Like, because they make references and jokes to, like, fandom jokes. Like, it's crazy. Like,
and the fact of the matter is that, of course, they see it. But like, the thing is that if you do something wrong, you'll hear about it, right? But if you're not, mm-hmm. if the company doesn't slam down the book at you, then guess what? Hey guys, what you've done is fine from an industry perspective. So yeah, this is the thing that I think is important to note, that fan service is this practice that is embedded within K-pop and visibilized within K-pop production, whereas it's very implicit in other media industries, where the celebrities and the management create moments to satisfy fan desires for particular things. And that could be anything from, like, you know, shipping culture, homoeroticism, to, mm-hmm. you know, as you say, jokes. Like my favorite one is the in joke that one member of NCT, Mark Lee, is actually secretly Spider-Man, and they actually build a whole skit around that in one of their shows. Like, you know what I mean? And the ultimate joke was that they made the joke was that their end citizens, the fans of this particular group, are kind of like, well, it's because Mark has such a tight, cute butt. And that's the joke that they made. Because, like, he'd look good in the Spider-Man outfit. It's ridiculous. But the thing is that they had this in a skit satisfying fans. And guess what? It was also an opportunity for fans to say, oh, look at that perky ass. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. So it's a thing. It's all brought in together. And I can tell you now that Mark Lee played along because that's what you do.
That sounds so much more fun just coming from, like, a fan of other boy bands' perspective, because it's, like, the closest I can think to, like, a band I liked doing things like that would be, like, Fall Out Boy or McFly, where they knew that their fans were shipping them, but, like, in a very kind, non-creepy kind of way, where it's, like, they know that it's fantasy, they know that, like, oh, there's not really any queer people in this space. If they're using our close friendship as a way to give themselves that thing, then, like, that's fine. We'll play it up. We'll do it. And like, that, I feel like that's what's so interesting, is it's, like, this fan service idea does, as you said, exist in Western society, but it's less obvious. It's less of a thing because the music industry here tries to be, like, we're not doing anything. We're just some big men with money. And, like, yeah. K-pop industry is like, no, we've trained them from the from day one to know how to make their fans happy. Everything they do is for you. And, like, obviously everything everybody does is for money, but, like, it feels so much more legitimate and real from K-pop because everything feels like an inside joke, even the homoeroticism. Whereas, like, with these, like, bands in America, when there is that, sometimes it just feels like some fans are like, oh yeah, like, they're just doing that to, like, appease to us, and other fans are like, oh no, they're actually, like, that's actually what they're like, whatever, you know? And, like, there's more of the blurred lines of, like, oh, that's just their personalities, they're not doing it for anybody except for themselves. But, like, it just sounds so fun to be a K-pop fan because they give you what you want. And it's, like, who wouldn't want that from a celebrity that you love? And, like, I guess this is my constant frustration with everything, is that, like, so many people seem to be trying to make K-pop be nefarious when it's not as nefarious as it is. Because, like, any conglomerate is going to have its nefarious side. But I feel like in using the term fetishization and using all these terms and using all these, like, angry words, they're trying to make something nefarious when it's really just, like, they're making something cutesy and fun with their fans. Yeah. And yet they're, like, still being capitalist, but, like, it doesn't feel like it in the same way that Western artists feel like it.
And this, to kind of bring things all the way back to the stuff we were talking about earlier in our conversation today, speaks to the structural issues that exist when K-pop has to compete with the global dominance of North American music industry and all of its white supremacy, heteronormative nonsense, is that the sad thing is that K-pop, like, is a threat, and, like, the media industry of North America has united against it to kind of hold it out. And, like, this idea of, like, why is, like, TMZ, like, showing all of these kind of attack pieces on K-pop? Why does every media outlet want to talk about the dark side of K-pop? Well, it's because the media outlets of North America are, you know, economically invested into the success of the North American music industry, so they have to tank. They have to tank what's going on. And, like, it's, you know, guys, you realize that there's reasons why that BTS don't win Grammys, right? It's because there's structural reasons.
Let's not get started.
Yeah,
let's not go there.
I know. Oh, yeah. But, like, but this is the thing. This is the thing. Like, there's, like, the reason that K-pop is always othered, and this is what it's othering, is because the dominant culture is not open to attack, right? Like, the perfect example of this, and I'm sure this will resonate with the two of you, is patriarchy, right? Like, no man is going to give up their power. Like, so it's the same. Like, and the problem is, and to bring this back to what we're talking about, is that we have all of these fans, through no fault of their own, who are actually doing the work of these problematic cultural industries, because they're still propagating these very rigid ideas around what is and is not right and cultural and whatnot. And like it's only when we kind of accept or kind of actually not accept, but it's only when we reject the logics of the dominant cultural forms, which is the North American music industry, and look for alternatives, the alternatives that K-pop are giving us, then yeah, we will get a world in which our celebrities are more than willing to dress up like a sexy Spider-Man and have their butt slapped just for our entertainment, right?
Oh my God. I'm going to have to look into this after this. The thing that like keeps popping up in my head as we're having this conversation is that I don't think we've had a very sexy male pop star in the American spotlight for some time. I mean, like, my mind would immediately go to Harry Styles, but he's not sexy in the way that K-pop is sexy. He's sexy in a very like toned down, like kind of muted way. And like, obviously One Direction was a huge boy band, but we haven't had like another like Western boy band craze, because I think right now pop girlies are doing great. Like female pop stars are killing it. Female rap stars are killing it. But then like the male stars are all very like masculine in a I'm cool way, not I'm trying to be sexy for the ladies way.
Yeah.
The only person who comes to mind is like Lil Nas, and he's great because
he's
like,
doing it for the gays.
And yeah, more which is, so than like, anyone I mean, else. Like, I can say as one of the gays, I'm very appreciative of him doing it for the gays. I just want to point it out. But yeah,
because like if you think about it, you do have a really good point. Because so Tom, we did an episode ages ago about the boy band to Yeah I Fuck pipeline, which started with Justin Timberlake, and all of those guys, it's a very masculine, like all of the promotion, all of the songs, everything is very male gazy, like what men think women want, but it's actually just what men find attractive in other men. And so it's, I think that right now the closest thing to like a female gaze pop guy, but like more hip-hop, would be like Jack Harlow, because all the girls are I don't understand him. I saw him on the Grammys red carpet,
and he was a boring man.
I don't know. I don't get it. But I think like that's the closest thing I can think of, because most of them are either like really masculine or like dirty in like the what's his face with all the face tattoos.
Post Malone.
Like, I just feel like you're either like super masculine male gazy or like maybe sleeping trash. Like, I don't think that there's
to step into this conversation and to suggest why there isn't like a Western boy band who is satisfying some of what we're talking about here is that we don't need one because we have BTS. Right?
Yes.
Like so true. this is the thing. Like BTS has stepped into the boy band void and has managed to transform that boy band. Like I think that what to me is really interesting is the fact that BTS have capitalized on the kind of post One Direction space. And I don't say this in the sense of like that they wouldn't have been successful without One Direction, because they would have been successful regardless of One Direction existing or not. But it's just that there was this particular moment in the late 2010s where we were dominant boy bandless, and BTS, and when I say we, I mean the North American music industry, because like if you look at East Asia, there's more than enough boy bands to go around. Yeah. Like that's the thing. So like, yes, we've got this moment where K-pop has filled that void. And I think that K-pop will continue to fill that void and eventually take over that void. Because the fact of the matter is that when it comes to having perfected the boy group formula, the Korean entertainment industries have cracked the code. They took what worked from North America, they took what worked in Japan, mixed it together, added some local innovations. Hey presto, you have a juggernaut that other people are now mimicking. And it's you know, to go back to the ridiculous statement from Simon Cowell a few years ago, it was like, we're going to create UK pop. I'm kind of like, yes, but in order to like resituate the UK as like the dominant, like kind kind of moment in pop cultural history, you need to copy Korea now, don't you? Or the rise of NCT Hollywood, which is, to be quite frankly, a nightmare, but at the same time, clear indication that the K-pop training method is going to spread. And we've already seen it spread. Some of the research I do is seeing how it's transformed the idol industries of both Japan and Thailand, and we've seen those become increasingly K-popified. The fact of the matter is, when Taylor Swift started selling like various different versions of her albums like a K-pop star, like that's when the K-popification of North America began. Like, and that was even before, you know, BTS was like within the mainstream. Because the fact of the matter is, BTS is mainstream now.
I mean, it's just fascinating because within the next 5 years, we're going to see so much change. And part of that too is Scooter Braun, Ithaca Holdings, like HYBE now owns that company, and Scooter Braun is an advisor to them integrating into America. HYBE has like detailed how they're applying their training programs to like find and build the next pop stars of America. And I think there's also a lot of American resistance against wanting to do this like quote unquote cultural institution of training.
And I think it's very interesting because like this is all from North Americans who don't realize that Hollywood was basically bankrolled and managed by Japanese people from the 80s onwards, right? Like
there's so many layers to it. And the thing that like I find interesting about what you just said, Jenna, is I feel like so many Western, specifically white celebrities, try to do that whole persona private life thing. I feel like there's going to be a lot of people who are going to think that they're cut out to be able to do what the K-pop industry does, like Western people. And then once they're told like, you like have to essentially act like a Kardashian in that you're going to have to like be calling the paparazzi, you're going to be having to do all these PR things that like don't feel natural, and that like we've seen time and time again Americans specifically like celebrities trying to separate themselves from. And so I just think it'll be really interesting to see how that works, because I would love for every artist to like be as dedicated to their fans as K-pop idols are, but I feel like the 1%, like the rich people, the celebrities of America, are so obsessed with like their image and being rich and being inaccessible to some degree that I feel like they're never really gonna do it unless they start training people at like age 10 and like start a deprogramming capital, like American capitalism. Like we're trying to deprogram
my only problem there is, of course, that deprogramming American capitalism and replacing it with South Korean capitalism means that we're still living in Bong Joon-ho's kind of transnational capitalism. So,
So to bring things back around to the sexualization thing, I mean, to Sarah's point earlier, K-pop idols talk about their fans like I've never heard any Western artist talk about their fans. Like their dedication to their fans, like it's even just, I mean, I like groups beyond BTS, but we often use BTS as a frame of reference for it's a lot of people's entryway into K-pop.
I did the same.
So the way BTS talks about ARMY is like I've never heard any Taylor Swift, probably one of the best examples of somebody who like works with her fandom and does things for her fandom. I've never heard, and of course I'm not a Swiftie, so like, you know, but I've just never heard any artist talk about their fans the way that BTS, the way that any K-pop group talks about their fans, where they genuinely have built a relationship with them over the years of like, ARMY is part of BTS's life, period. And so tying this into fan service, is there an element of fan service that's like feeding into this sexualization thing? Which I kind of feel like we just debunked a little bit, but I feel like there's people who would argue that by fans doing that, they're feeding into the idea of people continuing to objectify them.
Yeah, so one thing that it is important to note with regards to the kind of development of relationships between idols and their fans within the context of the South Korean pop culture industry, but also specifically about the South Korean context, is that the default kind of relationship that is supposed to be produced between the fan and the idol, or the nature of the parasocial relationship that is produced there, so the relationship that is defining that connection, is that you're either supposed to think of the idol as an older brother or a younger brother, depending on your age, or even your son, depending on how old you are. But the other principal relationship is that they're supposed to be like a boyfriend to you. And this is where the dating ban comes in, and why Korean fans in particular view dating as a great betrayal, whereas fans from other contexts, North America, Australia, what have you, kind of like, yeah, let them date, let them fuck around. Like, oh yeah, BT, like Taehyung was caught smoking at the Grammys. That's not a big deal. Whereas in South Korea, oh my God, that shit is big deal, like, right? But the thing is, yeah, it's a huge deal, big problem. Going to Hybe's gonna have to manage it, like, that's, and oh, like shit. To us it's kind of like, yeah, oh, he's smoking, whatever. But like, the fact of the matter is that one of the default fantasies that the K-pop industry sells, for better or for worse, is the fantasy of these are like your boyfriend. It isn't that they are your boyfriend, it's that they serve some of the social roles a boyfriend is supposed to do, which is that they step in to support you and give you feelings of happiness, and they're there for you when you need them, and blah, blah, blah. And they love you unconditionally, right? So this is one of those things where the specter of sexualization and objectification and fetishization raises its head, particularly for those who don't understand that K-pop fans who are immersed within the South Korean context know this, buy into it, and recognize that it is fantastic, i.e. that it's not real. So this is one of those things where it's a gray area. Like, I don't want to say it's bad or it's good. It's just that this is the nature of one aspect of the parasocial relationship. Like, members of a K-pop boy group or a K-pop girl group, like, they're girlfriends for their fans too, is something that's there. And for some people, if they're your imaginary or kind of fantastic boyfriend, or supposed to be an ideal partner, well, guess what you do with an ideal partner? You don't just walk down the street holding hands and singing, like, happy songs. You get down and dirty on bed, right? So, like, this is the thing. So this is where the quote-unquote sexualization begins to step in again. And that's okay. But as long as, like, the thing is that, as I said before, when it comes to fandom, most fans are critically reflexive fans. They understand that this is all fantastic. They know that they aren't their real boyfriends. And those who go really crazy hardcore down that really fantasy route become what in Korea known as saseng fans, obsessive stalker fans who everyone hates and who consistently get called out by the companies and the idols themselves. It's like, you have crossed a line. And once again, idols sign up fully knowing that they are going to be playing this role, that is one of their things. And as I said, for some fans, they're not boyfriends. They're older brothers, younger brothers, sons, or grandparents. Like, they're family relationships. But the fact of the matter is that what these people are doing is they're selling intimacy, and they're performing particular forms of what a colleague of mine, as I said, her name's Stephanie Trey, I should have named her, at New York University. She refers to it as the intimate labor of K-pop, that K-pop is structured around intimate labor on behalf of the idols for the fans, but also fans for the idols, and that it's reciprocal. They give each other energy through these performances.
That's just so interesting and so, I don't even, like,
validating.
I'm honestly, like, I'm kind of speechless of, like, how to respond to it, because it's so incredible that that's a thing, because people with Western groups are like me personally. I'm like, oh, Harry Styles, my son. Like, I want to protect him at all costs. But I just think it's so interesting that, like, they sign up for it knowing, like, that that's going to be part of it. Because I feel like, again, like I keep saying with so many Western artists, like, they're kind of like, I didn't sign up for this, like, blah, 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 blah. And, like, K-pop idols could never do that. And so it's, I just feel like that's such a healthier way to have parasocial relationships and to be a pop star and to just, like, be a celebrity, you know, and, like, have these things, because, like we keep saying, no matter what genre of music you're in, no matter what country you're from or whatever, like, when you're up there, your fans are going to be sexualizing you, your fans are going to be objectifying you in those ways, because we're all human, we all have needs, we all have wants, you know, it's inevitable. Like, it's not really possible. I mean, like, people fall in love with a random person on the subway every day, you know, like, it's they're not even a pop star. It's just a normal person you see reading a book on the tube. And it's just and so it's just really interesting that that's a, like, a predetermined part of K-pop.
It's a fundamental part of being human. And, like, not to, once again, kind of remove the aromantics and asexuals from our conversations, but even intense attraction, even, like, you know, there's someone you see and, like, I want to be friends with that person, they look so interesting, right? That feeling of intense emotional attraction to someone, whether that be sexual or otherwise, is a fundamental part of human beings. Like, we are supposed to be, like, our culture, remember, I defined this all the way at the beginning, culture emerges through human interaction. We are designed to interact with each other through all of the kind of channels that are open to us, whether that be our hearts, our minds, or other areas of our body that I will not name. Like, but the thing is that that's all natural, and that positive, like, to think about positive ways to engage with K-pop, it's about, recognizing that this is just how we engage with things as humans, and doing so in a reflexive, healthy way, you know, and doing so in ways that recognize that culture is shifting, not being afraid of that cultural shift, listening to the people whose voices have been marginalized, and taking on board what they have to say, but ensuring as well that those marginalized voices aren't attempting to repolice the world as well. So it's hard for me to say this as a white, like, Anglo-Australian sometimes, because of course my position as white Anglo-Australian is always already suspect. But, like, I think that there is a need for more empathy from everyone, like, everyone.
Yeah.
And like, K-pop is this fantastic, like, you know, fan wars and kind of crazy Delulu fans notwithstanding, like, it is actually a really welcoming, lovely space, and that everyone actually is just kind of united. Like, ARMY is the perfect example. ARMY don't just love BTS, they love each other. And I think that that's really powerful. And that's why ARMY have been so revolutionary in terms of transforming what fandom can be. And like, I think that there's a lot to learn from the fans of BTS for all kind of fandom cultures. And like, enough with the kind of fan wars that everyone engages in. And let's just kind of, like, have fun with things that are supposed to be fun.
So we had Lucy Ford, who's a UK journalist, on our podcast recently. We're talking about fandom from perspective of how, like, women engage with fandom versus men, which of course, as we always point out, is limiting in our conversations of gender. But one thing that she said is, she was like, I don't have to feel bad about things that are made for me. Like, it's fucking fun to have things that are made for me and to be able to enjoy it. And I think that's one of the things in doing this conversation of, I think there's this aspect of, you know, we're talking about objectification or fetishization. It's those things feel like people are trying to vilify, like, what you're doing when you're just being a part of fandom and engaging in the way that everyone is engaging in fandom. Yeah. But yet there's, like, this sinister thing that people are, like, trying to project onto it when it's not that way at all.
I mean, I think that it all boils down to, like, right now, like, after, like, I like to say this to my students, and I think that this will resonate with the both of you as Americans. Like, America has just gone through, like, 5 years of intense trauma, right? and it's going to take people a long time to overcome the fear and anger and instability of that particular moment in time. And right now we're still seeing, particularly among voices amongst the left and progressives, who haven't quite clicked that it's no, like, we're in a different moment, and what worked then is not necessary now. Mm-hmm. And, like, the fact of the matter is that K-pop became a big deal during that particular moment in North American history. So a lot of people engage with it still through that lens. I think that let's kind of move away from the politics of pessimism and embrace the politics of, like, the utopic politics of enjoyment. And I think that we'll be in a better place if we do that.
I think everyone just needs to take a cultural anthropology class.
A bit more, better perspective. I mean, We do enroll people in all sorts of degrees in my institution.
So I feel like we really have been able to bring this conversation full circle and have a lot of questions answered and like realize how we can engage in fandom in like a positive, healthy way and how we can engage in cultures in a positive and healthy way. So I guess just for like a final question here, I'm just reconsidering like with everything we've spoken on, kind of this globalization, coming back to our original question, which is the globalization of other cultures and maybe just reiterating the positive things that we can learn from this.
I think that for me, whenever something globalizes and it challenges what you consider to be normal in your cultural context and you encounter something that's so radically different, and if your immediate response to difference is, oh, there must be a problem with the thing that is different, that's a dangerous way to think. What you should be thinking is, how is the radical difference that I'm encountering showing me that what I have considered to be normal and logical and kind of unquestionable, how is that actually a product of where I've come from, and how does engaging with something like K-pop destabilize or lead me to question what I've always considered to be natural? And I think that that's really this asking of questions, ethical fandom, positive fandom, fandom that does not engage in that kind of solipsistic, selfish fantasy projection of what is truly fetishization, as opposed to fetishization as the empty buzzword to kind of critique people and police their behavior. Like, that's the difference. Question, question, question. Like, and I say this to my students constantly when I'm teaching about K-pop, when I'm teaching about Japanese media as well. I say to them, you're engaging with something that may make you uncomfortable. You may not understand why other people enjoy this so much. It is not your place to judge. It is them. It is your place to reflect on yourself and think, why is my reaction this way? What has led me to think this way? And the fact of the matter is that all of these K-pop fans who are quote-unquote fetishizing the idols because suddenly they're so obsessed with Korea when they were, you know, 10 years ago obsessed with One Direction, that's a good thing because it means that they're questioning the world. And yes, maybe they're misfiring every now and then, but you know what? No one's perfect. And it's a journey. Yeah. And culture changes, and you should be engaging with people in good faith and leading them to understand things, not closing doors, opening them for them. Open doors, don't close them. I think that's my ultimate kind of position.
I love it so much. I feel like that's a very positive note to end this on. So Thomas, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for sharing all of your amazing knowledge with us today.
Thank you for giving me a place to rant, I guess. I hope that it came across as like, it made sense. Like, and if it doesn't make sense, well, people can always scream at me on Twitter. I'm used to that.
Not our listeners. They're well-behaved and they love learning. So we'll have links to your work and your Twitter and whatnot. So if any of our listeners want to go find out more, we'll have that all linked in the description below. So yes, thank you once again for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So what did you think, Sarah?
I loved every part of that conversation. I feel like we learned so much about K-pop, but also just like the world. And yeah. I feel like a lot of the points that Tom made can really like correlate with a lot of other conversations we've had in the past, which I think is really awesome because it's just so cool when you go into a conversation being like, oh, this is like very specifically about one genre of music, when really the ideas play into so many other things and there's so many levels to it.
Yeah, and I think when we were like planning for this episode and whatnot, I was saying it's like the conversation we're having today is kind of about K-pop. It's about like the criticisms and the way that fandom interacts with K-pop, but you can copy and paste this conversation onto like American media, which is kind of what we ended up doing to a certain degree. And that also reminded me a lot of our episode with Stephanie when we were talking about like K-pop and capitalism, and like as we were essentially like, what does K-pop help us learn about America, about the world? Yeah. Like the criticisms that K-pop and K-pop fandom gets is really just reflective of the people who are criticizing it, which are white Americans. Well, I mean, just America in general, or Western, different experiences from around the world. So yeah, I think it really like answered a lot of questions for me and like a lot of things that I felt unsure about, or like, like, why are these types of conversations happening? I feel like it just like helped clarify a lot of things.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think that existing on Twitter is going to be a lot easier now. Because I just feel like people call each other out for like the dumbest things, or will say things again because they think they're being woke, they think they're being smart, but when really it's like mostly what people are doing and like how they're exhibiting their fandom or their lust for somebody or what have you is mostly in like a not nefarious way. Like everything is just very fandom being fandom, but because it has a different look to it and whatever, people are misunderstanding it and misrepresenting it with their words and turning things dark and scary when they don't need to be.
Yeah, and I think there's also that aspect of like judging things you don't know and also like not doing the work to try to get to know them. I feel like there's a lot of that too.
Yeah, 100%. So for our lovely listeners, I feel like this is definitely one of those episodes that we're going to want to discuss. So I'm sure we will go do a fun little Instagram live about this at some point before our next episode, as well as just like come to the comments, come to the DMs, do whatever, chat with us on social media, because I'm just really curious as to what your guys' thoughts are on this idea of globalization, this idea of like what culture means and how culture is changing and the positives that K-pop expanding into like this international thing is really bringing to everybody. Because I think that this conversation really changed my outlook and my understanding on a lot of these terms and a lot of what this means. So I'm super curious to hear your guys' thoughts and feelings. So come hit us up on social media. We are at Name3Songs on Instagram and Twitter. And you can talk to us personally if you have any thoughts or feelings or beef about anything either of us said. I am at Sarah_Fagan and Jenna is at Jenna_Million. And thank you all for joining us on Name3Songs this week. Until next time, never let anyone make you feel bad about your favorite band.
And remember, you're never too cool to listen to K-pop.
Don't forget to subscribe to be notified when each episode comes out and leave us a 5-star review. They really help.
If you want to find out more about any of the things we referenced in this episode, you can visit Name3Songs.com.